Welcome to Journeys of Romance. I'm your host, Jess Michaels. Today's guest has been, I feel like, a central figure in Romancelandia for a really long time, but her debut novel was just released in January, so there's a whole bunch of stuff to discuss and celebrate. Please welcome Adele Buck.
Thank you. The face that I made when you said a central figure in Romancelandia, I'm like, moi?
I've been aware of you for so long. Do you know what I mean? But when you were saying, oh, my debut book is coming out, and I was like, is it? In January? Because I just feel like we've floated past each other for what feels like not an insignificant amount of time.
definitely. I can't remember when we initially connected. So yeah, same. But so much of my Romancelandia connection comes from the internet. And sometimes, you know, especially when people change their avatar, I'm like, oh, wait, that's the same person. Oh, okay. and every Halloween when everybody changes their avatar and it's a spooky name, I'm like, who are you? Oh, you're my best friend. Oh, okay.
That's right. Like at Christmas time and Halloween and, you know, whatever, I'm just like, no, please, no. And I mean, it's cute and it's fun, but then it's like find the person. I'm like, who are you?
Waldo in reverse? Yes. It's like everybody's Waldo. So nobody's Waldo. I don't know where that metaphor came from, but yeah.
And I enjoy a good celebration, but I'm always so excited when holiday season is over, because I'm like, okay, now we all get to go back to being just us, and I know who everyone
right.
is.
Right. Well, yeah, it's funny because when I got my cover draft from Marika Bailey, so shout out to Marika Bailey, who's my amazing cover designer and illustrator. I texted Jace Ellis, who is a very dear friend of mine, and I'm like, okay, I've got this cover, and the illustration is so great. And I said, is it like too extra for me to commission a social media avatar from her in the same style, or is it just extra enough? And she's like, she basically was like, honey, there's no such thing as too extra in this business.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's no such thing as too extra.
And so the thing is, so when I asked Marika, I was like, you know, how much would you do this for? And can I afford it? And then, you know, we came to, you know, yes, fine. And so I sent her the original picture that was my avatar before, so that she could use that as a cover model, so as to not confuse people too much. So it's like, it's not...
Right, be close enough.
Yeah, it's a cartoon version of my picture, which was taken by my professional photographer brother. So, I mean, I'm like in really good hands visually, which is great because I am not an artist.
Right. When some people... And I think that's like a super important thing because... You know, especially now that illustrated covers are becoming more common and more people are self-publishing, like people think that they can be good at that aren't. Some people are great at it. But I mean, occasionally you see a cover and you're like, oh, no. No, you shouldn't have done that yourself.
Yeah. Oh, the bad Photoshop is just, it's wow.
Yeah.
Because the thing is, I am no good at doing it myself, and I will freely admit that to anybody. But oftentimes when I do know when something is bad. Mm-hmm. And you know, bless people for trying, because it's, you know, that's really hard stuff and everything, but yikes.
Well, I mean, I think that just because you have a creative ability in one sense, like as a writer, does not mean, because like, I can't draw a straight line. Like, you know what I mean? I cannot freehand a straight line. So I would never think like, you know what I ought to do?
Oh, my stick fingers gout. Talking, are you kidding?
Oh my God. Yeah. No, they're a mess. They're unhappy people.
Yeah. Very unhappy people.
But I mean, it's a good thing. And I think someone had said the other day, like, no one really, you know, we say, oh, here's my beautiful cover. But sometimes we're not always great about saying, oh, this is from, you know, for me, like Teresa Speckelmeyer from, you know, Midnight Muse. And the photo is by Jen LeBlanc. Like, we don't necessarily always completely give credit when we know it. You know what I mean? So I think as we're sort of developing as artists and as a, you know, as a industry, I think that it's a good thing that more and more people are being like giving that credit where credit's due.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the other parts of that conversation that was news to me, because I have not been traditionally published, was that oftentimes publishers will not allow their authors to give anything other than the art department at blank press, which is really, you know, I'm sure there are... I always try to not immediately go, oh, that's stupid, or that's, you know, that's foolish, to something I have just learned about. So I won't say that because I'm sure there are probably some very good reasons. And as someone who is trained as a lawyer, you know, oftentimes those reasons are legal. And well, I should backtrack and say that not necessarily that they're good reasons, but that they're legally valid reasons. Right. but it's sad because, you know, if I couldn't say at every, and I do it every turn, Marika Bailey, Marika Bailey, Marika Bailey. Oh, by the way, Marika Bailey is my cover artist. Isn't she amazing? I would be really sad about that because, yep. Especially because, and I guess if I were a traditionally published author, I would not have this relationship. She and I have had this wonderful creative collaboration where, you know, we get to have a back and forth that's very direct and very, oh, I love this bit. And, you know, like for instance, on my cover, you know, I got the first draft of the cover and I had like two edits, I think. One of them was to make Paul's hair shaggier because Paul is one of these like distracted artist types. And he was explicitly based on the character Jeffrey from Slings and Arrows, which is a Canadian television show about a Shakespeare festival. And he's played by the beautiful actor Paul Gross. So I had this lovely image of this gorgeous man in my head the entire time I was writing it. So I really wanted that shaggy hair because, you know, one of the first things that Kath, the heroine, thinks about him is, ugh, he's just too good looking with that. And even with that hair, he's like Adonis escaped from the Muppet Show. and then the other thing was is that I said, oh, can we have Kath is a stage manager. Can we have her three-ring notebook with her script? And Marika's like, absolutely. So to the side of the stool where Kath is sitting on, there's this little three-ring binder, like a faithful puppy sitting by her feet. And the other thing that happened was that I noticed that Marika gave them almost to the exact same sneakers on the cover.
Oh, that's funny.
And so because I had some time and because I hadn't uploaded the final draft of the book itself, I just sneakily wrote in a little reference to it. From the antagonist has this correspondence with her other actress frenemy, and she's basically like, they even wear the same kind of sneakers. It's just nauseating.
See, but that's what I really like about doing it indie, because mm-hmm. you know, you get to have that more of that influence. I mean, when I wrote, because mm-hmm. I did publish traditionally for a long time. Mm-hmm. I mean, I didn't see the cover until like we were a long time into the process before I saw the cover. So I was done. Like I was maybe I was still doing some level of editorial, but I wasn't actively writing. And so if something didn't match on the cover, it just wasn't going to match, and then everybody was going to yell at me. But you know, now it's like I mean I do cover shoots before I write. Because mm-hmm. sometimes, because like, I don't really care what they look like. Every once in a while, like, someone is a very specific reference. Like, you had a very specific reference there for a specific reason, obviously.
Right.
But, I mean, I don't always think like, oh, this guy is a, you know, Tom Hardy. Ooh. Anyway, I don't always think that, though.
She just drifted off like, there for a minute, people.
Yeah, hang on a second. I'm just going to have a moment. But she's supposed to get herself back. Sometimes you're like, the guy's a Tom Hardy, right? Like, he's like, there's a reason. And sometimes you're just like, he's a dude. So, I mean, for me, if I shoot first, then sometimes I see something in a model, you know, or in the chemistry between the models that makes me change something about that book. And I enjoy that process a lot. I miss it now that we can't do that because of COVID. But I mean, like, you know, the same thing. It's like you saw it became a character, a piece of the character, a piece of the connection of the characters, because they, you know, just that little throwaway thing from the cover. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that becomes like kind of part of your creative process. And I mean, I don't know. I love that. I don't miss like just kind of having giving people a basic idea and then whatever happens is kind of out of your hands. I don't miss that part at all.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because I was very much done writing the book. Mm-hmm. And I think I literally added a sentence just to nod to that, just because I could, because I hadn't completely finished my KDP and my Ingram orders. And so I was just like, I can do one more file upload of that PDF.
And it's not going to change the length. So I'm not going to screw up my cover. Exactly. I'm not going to screw up my paperback.
Exactly. Yeah.
But that is the control. And I love that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so that was just a ton of fun. And God help me, I'm on the second book, which I'm working on right now. I mean, literally working on finalizing the formatting of the interior and getting cover templates and all of that. I'm like, the last time I did it, I did it on a bit of a short timeline, which, you know, for a first outing, that is a very foolish thing to do. The one thing that was good about it was that, so it came out on January 22nd, and I'm an academic law librarian. And so basically every Christmas, because the university is closed, we get a week and a half off. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I just extended that by 3 days and took full 2 weeks off. So I knew I was going to have 2 full weeks, basically 3 weeks before I actually put the book out, where I could just intensively do all the things and not have to worry about day job and not have to do any of that. So that was the only saving grace of that really short timeline, was that I had, you know, 2 weeks where I could say, oh, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to write a magnet because I need to drive people to my newsletter, hopefully.
Right.
That kind of thing. And for anybody who doesn't know, a magnet is one of those like, hey, did you like this book? You know, I want to have one more chapter with these characters, you know, go to Book Funnel and download it. And if you want to, or sometimes people make you, I don't make you, you know, sign up for my newsletter. So I was able to write that final, the final extra chapters for both Acting Up and for Method Acting, which is the next book. So that was the only thing I did, which was not incredibly foolish. I made all the mistakes in the book.
Well, yeah, but I mean, that's the thing, right? I mean, that's something that I wanted to talk to you about, you know, I mean, mm-hmm. So you've been in the trenches for a while. I mean, you've been pursuing publication and writing, I know, for not, you know, this isn't like your first rodeo, really. It's just what, you know, this is the way that you've decided to get published.
Right.
What were you surprised by anything? I mean, even after having experience and having a lot of friends in the industry, I mean, it's, you know, it's one thing to talk about, it's another thing to do it. Was there anything that took you by surprise?
Yes and no, I guess. I mean, because the thing is, I had an agent for, I guess, about 4 years. Mm-hmm. And actually Acting Up was the book that she signed me with. And, you know, she liked it. She thought it was really charming. And you know, the thing about me, I guess, is that New York Publishing, a lot of editors were like, I really, really like it. I don't know what to do with it.
Yeah.
Which is not unusual. So, you know, hey.
Yeah.
And so after 4 years of that and of, you know, kind of keep, you know, I would write something that was very different and I'd get the same notes back. She and I were just like, well, this just isn't working, is it? You know, and we parted on extremely amicable terms. She's still a friend and everything was fine. And it was certainly, it was not the apocalyptic event that I would have thought it would have been if I thought about it 4 years ago. And then I said, you know, I'm just going to go back to that series because I have, including the book that's already out, I have 7 romances that are completed manuscripts written.
Yeah.
2 series. And then I have an additional 2 women's fiction manuscripts. So I've got pipeline.
Yeah.
So it's been weird. I haven't really been writing. I've been like editing and I've been planning and I've been, you know, I'm like, I
getting covers and doing all that stuff.
Yeah.
Do you have a specific strategy that you're executing? I mean, obviously this next one is coming out fairly quickly, which is good.
Yeah.
And that's going to help with that Amazon algorithm. But, sure. Like what, you know, what is kind of your, do you kind of have a strategy that you're thinking that's in place?
My strategy for the first series is to get all 4 books out, hopefully this year. So I've got boom, backlist.
Yeah.
And all 4 of these books have something to do with theater. And so it, to some extent, that's a niche market. I think fully 50% of the people who looked at Acting Up said, oh, books set in the theater don't sell.
Right.
And I kept thinking, have you heard of Lucy Parker? I mean, because she does pretty well. and in fact, she actually blurbed the book. And if you ask me what surprised me, I mean, one of the things that surprised the ever living heck out of me was, so a few years ago, Suzanne Brockman, pause for choirs to sing, became a friend of mine. And, I know I was this absolutely starstruck, geeked out fangirl. And when she won the Lifetime Achievement Award, We were, you know, she was there in the lobby and I was sort of standing aside waiting to, you know, say hi to her. And she turned around and her face, she recognized me. Her face lit up and I immediately burst into tears. And I am not a crier. I mean, I do cry sometimes, but this is not something I do at the drop of a hat usually. And so, you know, I settled down and we had pictures and she said, you know, do you want to have a drink with me tomorrow night? And I was like, yes, please. Okay. And she sat down with me for an hour and we had this great conversation and her family joined us and they're just lovely people. And I just was so, you know, like, wow, I get to spend an hour with Suzanne Brockman. And at the end of this, she said, she looked, like, put her hand on my shoulder. She looked at me very seriously. She said, we're friends now, okay? Like, the subtext was, you can stop fangirling like a maniac.
You're in the inner circle.
Yeah, right. And so we corresponded a little bit. And finally, when I decided to go to publish this book, I let her know. And she said, oh, would you send me a copy? And I said, sure. So I sent her an arc of, you know, file and didn't think anything of it. And about a week and a half, 2 weeks before publication, she sends me this email. And, you know, she tells me first of all how much she enjoyed it. And, you know, she and I are both New Englanders and the book is set in Connecticut. And so she's like, you nailed the New England setting and, you know, this, that, and the other thing. And it included three blurb quotes.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
Yeah. And I immediately emailed Marika because we had a final cover. I'm like, Suzanne Brockman blurred my book. She's like, do you want the cover changed? I'm like, can we? You know, my tone of voice could probably have called dogs from three counties around me. So that was probably the biggest surprise. The second biggest surprise was I was just scrolling Twitter as I am all too wont to do. Prior to going to bed one night, and I ran across three or four friends of mine who had this kind of mini thread. They hadn't tagged me, so I didn't say anything. And they were all talking about how, you know, like one of them was in the middle of it, a couple of them had just finished it, and they're all talking about how much they enjoyed it. And I was just like, oh, oh my goodness.
That is the coolest part, when people really start to read it. Like, it's cool when people that you know read it. That's always super cool. And they like it. Although it's always kind of nerve-wracking. I don't know.
Maybe,
you know, when you know the people that you know are reading it, and if they hate it, they're going to have to, like, fake it. And you're going to know that they're faking it.
Or they're just going to say awkward. Nothing.
Yeah, oh, no, I thought the cover was beautiful. Like, it's going to be awkward. But, like, it is such a cool thing and always continues to be such a cool thing when someone you have absolutely no relationship to is like, oh, my God, I love your work. And you're like, I always feel like I'm like, me? Like, I'm looking back.
Yeah, you're looking over your shoulder like, who are you talking to? What? Yeah.
But there is, I mean, because it's like, we do so much of this, even when we're active on social media and have a lot of friends that are writers, you know, and have a lot of interaction about it. It's still a very solitary endeavor.
Yep.
That you create this thing and, you know, you don't really know how it's going to fare in the world until it goes into the world. And then it doesn't really belong to you anymore.
Right.
You know, I mean, now it belongs in the ether and now now it belongs to whoever's reading it. And however they respond to it is a perfectly rational and reasonable response for the most part.
Right. Exactly.
So, I mean, I always, you know, I'm like, oh, you know, how is it? I really like it, but are other people going to like it?
Exactly. Yeah. And it's funny because, you know, I've had several careers and the first one was I was an actress myself. And so I have a really like kind of detached approach to reviews and criticism. And so what's really funny is, so, you know, I said something to Jace because I do look at my author dashboard and I don't look at the individual reviews because I don't want I want a sort of a sense of the top line star rating, pretty much. That's it, you know, how many people have read it and that kind of thing, on Goodreads, I mean, specifically. And so I was chatting with my mom on FaceTime, and, you know, my husband sort of buzzing around in the background. My husband, who is known to Twitter as Mr. B, he's sort of buzzing around in the background, you know, doing his thing in the kitchen. My husband is an outstanding cook and luckily loves to do it, which is great because I really don't like to cook.
I know, I hate it.
I basically married an Italian grandmother with, you know, with an XY chromosome.
Nice.
which is great. And so he's buzzing around in the background doing something in the kitchen, and you know, mom's asking me, she's like, what's the critical reception of it? Have you, do you know? And I said, oh, well, you know, so I've got some good, you know, some good, some bad. You know, some people seem to really like it. Some people, not so much. And in the background, Mr. Beast goes, good people on Goodreads are idiots. And I'm like, honey, are you okay? And he was like super incensed on my behalf. He's like, I don't understand people who say they love it and give it like 3 stars. And I'm like, it's okay. They can do that, honey. So I thank you. Thank you for defending my honor. I mean, my husband is, he is the picture of a mild-mannered librarian, okay? He is not Mr. like swashbuckling, you know,
but he's barbarian. Ready to fight, it sounds like.
Yeah, he's ready to fight Goodreads. I'm like, no, honey, you know, no, keep your powder dry, it's okay.
But it's so funny because, like, it is, see, and again, I mean, I think people, they don't, sometimes they don't know how to separate, right? Because, like, mm-hmm. it is a perfectly rational response for him to look and be like, that makes no sense to me, I'll fight him, you know. Right. The problem becomes when you actually take that out into the street. Like, it's okay for you two to say to each other, that's, you know, or I can't believe anyone would dislike this book. This book is perfect. Like, it's perfectly fine to feel that way. And then, but the problem becomes when we cross over that line and we start going on good, you know, on Twitter and calling out people about it.
Oh, like, God, no.
Yeah, it's just, because, I mean, then now you're in a whole other mess. And you know, I mean, of course it's weird when someone's like, I loved everything about it. This might be the best book I've ever read. 2 stars. I'm like, oh, do you not understand the star system? Do I not understand the star system?
Like, someone has a disconnect here. Yeah.
Yeah. Something is happening. But, like, you know, you can't go tag them and send people after them. And especially, oh, again, God, like, no. Sometimes there's legitimate criticism, you know?
And sure.
And it's just, I don't know. I mean, again, I think, like you said, coming from the theater, having criticism, you know, sort of lobbed at you in some other environment, I think does, you know, make you maybe a little bit more, you have to learn to live with it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't ever look at reviews either. But I did have a NetGalley like co-op. So that's, you know, one of the things, one of my, you know, before the book is out, things that I do to promote.
Right.
Just to get it out there on NetGalley, and you go get the reviews. And of course, it sends me every single email when someone reviews it in the NetGalley system. And I mean, it's so hard because I'm just like, I just want to file it. I'm just filing it. I'm not looking at it. And it, I mean, some days, though, man, like, it is so hard not to open it and just be like, I'm going to wallow in my pain.
Yeah, especially if it gives you any sort of preview and you can see some of it. Because, you know, the people who say, just don't read, guess what? If your eye lands on something, you're reading it. It's automatic. And so unless it's obscured and you have to click to open it and see all of the, you know, any of the content, you're going to see what you're going to see and you're going to read it because that's just human nature. It just happens.
It's totally human nature.
It's not even human nature. It's automatic. It's like, you know, you see letters, you learn to read when you were however old you were, 4 or 5 or 6, and boom, it's in your brain. It's just there. It's not a conscious decision to say, oh, I'm going to read this, unless you actually click it, open it, and start to read the entire thing. So I get it. I mean, like, back when criticism, you know, is fine. I have to say that, you know, just depending on the day, when I was still in the sub trenches with my agent, mostly rejection, I was sort of like, you know, it's like auditioning. And I was like, well, you know, that wasn't right for their list. Okay, fine, I get it. And just some days, like, I mean, I don't know if you know this, a lot of people do, is so 2.5 years ago, I had this sudden happen in my back. And what it was a massive herniated disc.
Oof.
And so they wouldn't operate on it for like a year because they thought it was going to resolve itself, because usually basically these things sort of dry up essentially. They just do. Well, mine didn't. And so I finally had surgery a year later, and I'm a person who needs to be kept busy. I like to say that I'm a border collie. You need to give me a job or else I'm going to be bored and possibly destructive, right? Well, apparently my body is the same way, because my body took this soft tissue that was a disc and turned it into bone, basically. It calcified this. So my 1 hour simple surgery turned into a 4 hour complicated surgery. So I have had, and luckily it's getting a lot better lately, But I've had chronic pain now for, you know, almost 2.5 years. And so I learned that on a really bad chronic pain day, getting a batch of rejections from New York publishers was enough to make me want to dig my own grave.
Yeah. Wait, because it is so, the reaction is so based on, like, if I'm having a bad day, you know, I have a spat with my husband, you know, my father right now is, he was just diagnosed with cancer in August. Mm. So like, I'm worried about him, you know, or I don't know, like something just happened in the world. I woke up on the wrong side of the bed. Those are the days when I'm like,
yeah, exactly. It'll just send you.
It just hits you in the right spot when you're, cause it's almost like, I feel like we're, you know, we're a glass, right? And you're filled up to the top and then you hit a certain level and now it's like you're in the danger zone and everything is going to like, just take you out from under you. Like, you know, if you think you suck, someone else thinks you suck. So they mention someone else and you're like, why didn't they mention me? Or why did they mention me? I mean, like anything can set that off. And I mean, that's not true for everyone. I'm sure there are some very healthy, emotionally healthy authors and I hate them, but like I think for most of us, most people that I've talked to, like we all have our, and we all have a trigger point too, all have the point where we're like, that's it. And again, like that chronic pain, like if that empties out your glass, like it gets you to that trigger point a lot sooner. I think
it's amazing, because actually when I came back from the surgery, I was talking to someone, because I was out for a good long time after that, because you know spinal surgery, it really takes it out of you.
It's serious.
Imagine that.
Yeah,
it's funny because they, you know, I work for an academic law library and I used to commute on the same train with our assistant director, who is from South Carolina. And, you know, we were talking about my upcoming surgery right before I had it. And I said, well, I usually heal pretty fast. So hopefully I'll be back, you know, in this time frame. And I was getting my surgery in late November. And so as I mentioned before, I've got Christmas break coming up. I thought I'd be back before Christmas break. And he just looked at me with this big smile. I said, don't be a hero. He's like, take the time you need. And I did. I actually stayed home through the Christmas break. And then when I went back in January, I went back for a full week and I contacted my surgeon and I said, okay, going back for a full week right off the bat, bad idea. This is overstretching me. Can I go back for 2 days? Can I get a note basically saying, work for 2 days, stay home on Wednesday, work for 2 days? And he turned that thing right around. And so that's what I did for a month, which was great because that really helped me recuperate.
Yeah, you needed that rest period.
I did. I needed that rest. And oh my, it's a really nice work schedule too, just in general.
So how did that affect your writing? Because obviously, I mean, you know, writing is a pretty... Like you're still a lot of the time.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
not great for your back to start with. So did that impact the way that you wrote? Did it change your system for how you created?
Yeah. You know, because I'm stubborn and silly, I did, and especially initially, because what happens is that, you know, you get sciatica, which is the disc is pressing on the sciatic nerve, which runs down, in my case, the outside of my right leg. And so it was creating either intense numbness or when it kind of backed off a little bit, but was still pressing on the nerve, extreme pain all down my leg. So you can imagine sitting was really not a great idea. But of course I was trying to do it anyway, because I have, you know, I'm one of those people who actually does mostly do a daily writing practice and I don't find it to be a burden, and you know, my word count shifts depending upon the project, but and I was trying to work through it, and I can tell you that manuscript ended up in the, you know, virtual dustbin. I was able to salvage like 2 scenes from it, and sort of rework them for a totally different book, but that was it. So when I was really in the intense part of the pain, I just had to you know, stop. But when I was more manageable, I was still able to do it because I'm, you know, if I wasn't writing, I'd be knitting or I'd be doing something.
Right, you have to do something.
I did a lot of reading when I was really in the worst part of it. I literally did the entire Beyond Glom, Kit Roche's. Oh,
that's a long series, right? That's a really long series.
Yeah. Yeah, and I was
suck it all in.
I had gotten the ultimate glom when they put it out for a buck.
Oh, nice.
And I was like, this is the opportunity for me to actually read this. Now, do I remember a lot of it? No, I don't. But you know what was great about that particular series is it's so immersive.
Yeah.
That it really took me outside of myself and let me cope with the pain because, you know, because doctors in this country don't really believe you when you say, I'm in the worst pain of my life. So I was coping with a lot of this pain with very little support. Chemically, at least. And lying down was really the only way I could get any sort of relief.
Yeah.
And so I did. So I lay down and I glommed that entire series. And then I bought the one book that isn't included in it that had come out after the glom came out. And I read that as well. but that was really what I did. And I've told Donna and Bree that book got me through.
Yeah.
Or those books got me through that pain. And it's funny because at one point, really out of the blue, Donna sent me a very early arc of Deal with the Devil.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I was like, what? what is this?
Like, don't say anything in case it's a mistake.
Right, right. And it's in my inbox. It is not. I am not letting it go. And so that was really, really sweet of her. And I still don't know why, but I suspect it was because she knows that, you know, that their writing really did get me through that really horrible, horrible time.
Well, and the cool thing is that your writing will do that for someone else. You know what I mean? Like, like a path down the lane. Like, I think that's the thing that I've really gotten out of this last, you know, year, almost year and a half now, or whatever, for, you know, year, I guess, with COVID, is that, you know, so many people have reached out and said, reading romance in general, or reading your books, or reading these books, or reading this book has been the thing that's kept me sane. That's been the thing that's kept me, you know, going. That, you know, and so that's like the beauty of what we do. And I mean, that's why I think it's so frustrating when people, you know, shit on it. Like, well, okay, good for you. Like, we create hope. So, you know, if you don't want hope, that's fine. You don't have to read hope, but like, you don't have to bash on somebody else's desire for it.
Yeah. I mean, I really, really have a beef with this sort of underlying notion that in literature especially, that misery equals quality.
Yeah.
I really, really take issue with that. And it's funny because I had a boss previously who was otherwise a pretty decent feminist dude. And, you know, when I signed with my agent, and he's like, oh, just as long as you don't, you know, publish with Harlequin. And I looked at him and I said, why would I not want to deal with the largest single publisher in my genre? Would I not want that? And he was kind of like taken aback. And then he probably said something about the covers of his mom's books. And I was like, could you possibly update your references to this century?
Yeah. Well, and I feel like this year all of us have just broken. Like, we're like, screw off. Like we're just so done.
I think we've been there for years.
I mean, this year just feels like our visceral response has been so much sharper. Like, if you come in here, we will stab you with these knives.
Yes,
get out.
We will cut you. Well, you know, and for your listeners, tomorrow is Valentine's Day. So it's funny because
we are just coming out. Yeah,
romance writers are really on edge at this time of year. You'd think that because we're romance writers, it would all be hearts and flowers and all. And what we know is we know these hit pieces are going to come out.
Like, and this
one that recently came out on Slate, which took two newbies who clearly already hated the genre, and they read a 20-year-old book. Yes, it's relevant because it was the first Bridgerton book, which was just made into a TV miniseries. However, it's still a 20-year-old book, you know? And it's the miniseries itself might be relevant to the cultural zeitgeist of the moment, fine, whatever. The book is really not. And also, we've already had a lot of these conversations about...
Yeah, like, they acted like they were saying something brand new and special. And it's like, dude, we've heard this for so long. Like, I've been doing this for 20 years. Like, and I've heard your stupid tale, like, for 20 years. And I'm not even the oldest one. So, like, jog on. Like, you're not cool. And then the one of the writers was like, well, I also wrote a piece about, you know, Alyssa Cole. And all of us were like, okay, we're doing that?
Right.
Oh, yeah. It was so frustrating.
Let me use a black woman as a crutch. No, don't do that.
Yeah. I mean, it was just so ridiculous. And,
yeah.
You know, I mean, again, I think it's just that it happens every time.
Every year.
And it's just so exhausting to have to always have this conversation. This year, I was just like, I'm bailing out of this. I can't. I've done this right. too many, tiny times. I don't feel like doing it. Because right. again, like, I mean, especially this year, again, like, you have a whole year having gone by where romance and hopeful fiction, like romance, but mostly romance, has been so impactful and helpful to people. Right. In the most traumatic of situations culturally, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
And then you also have that we raised $1 bazillion for freaking almost democracy.
$500,000. Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, so like, we don't have time for this now.
Right.
Like, we just, like, we never do, but we, like, especially don't right now, you know? I mean, and again, to be fair, I think we've had a lot more positive pieces come out in the last year. But,
well,
I mean, it's just when they come and they, I mean, it's always Valentine's month, you know, it's always February and they always just keep coming. And I mean, it just seemed like there were a lot of real bad hot takes in 2021, since some of you will be listening to this in 2023. Like 2021, it was not a good year for romance hot takes. So hopefully, you know, you guys in the future, 2023, I hope it's real good this year.
Well, you know, we've got some journalists that, you know, who have gained some prominence, who are unabashedly fans of the genre, which really helps. So we've got the Carly Lane Perrys, and we've got the Jamie Greens, and we've got the Kaylee Donaldson, is that her last name? I can't remember, who writes for Pajiba. You know, and there are more. I'm terrible with names. But so we have these people who are out there and who have the cultural clout to say, let me write from the inside of the, you know, an insider's knowledge of the genre, which is fantastic. And so that's, I think that's, it's not new, but I think that the greater volume of voices like that, who actually, you know, are taken seriously by assigning editors, it's meaningful. And I'm really happy about that. So there's the silver lining. But one of the other funny things that somebody else said about this whole, like, hot take thing that we deal with year after year, especially in February, is that each one of these articles, you know, decries the genre for being, you know, repetitive, cliche, etc. And as if we couldn't set our watches by the exact same repetitive cliche things you say about the genre.
Right.
I wish I could remember who made that point, because I'd love to quote them.
I remember because it was a very good point. And it's also an extremely good point, which was also made by someone else that was much smarter than me, that it's always this implication that, like, no one has ever read romance. Let's hear what the fuss is about. And it's like, but we're a billion-dollar industry. There's a whole lot of people reading it.
And
again, it's like, why don't you speak to that? Like, what, you know, what is, you know, how have people been impacted by the kind of hopeful fiction that romance is during COVID? Like, again, you could do 50,000 amazing spins right now.
And you could also realize or surmise, and then do some research and find out that you were right, that the people, that the writers, the readers, the critics within the genre have also had some very hard conversations about what are we doing culturally? How are we doing good, but how are we doing harm, and how can we not do that anymore? Because we have had those conversations. Have they always been fruitful? Have they circled back upon themselves? You know, yes and no. We are as much of a mess as the rest of our species, right? But it's not, are there people who are going, you know, tripping along, going, la, 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 I think, you know, everything is fine because I'm fine? Of course there are.
Sure.
But there are also pockets of us who have had very hard conversations, mm-hmm. or who have sat on the sidelines and said, I am not experienced enough or smart enough, but I can tell that these are really experienced, smart people. I am going to read these Twitter threads, or I'm going to listen to these conversations on podcasts or what have you, and do that work, because we have. And I think that it's entirely insulting to have these hot takes that implicitly assume that we have not.
Right. Well, and also, again, and assume that the reason that we're upset is because we don't want criticism of the genre. Mm-hmm. I am absolutely fine to have a hard critical look at the genre. We do it a lot for ourselves, and we don't do it enough, even when we do it a lot. Like, this is, we have a lot of problems in romance genre. I write historical romance. We have massive problems in historical romance. Like, it's, we... we need to have the conversations. I just want those conversations to come from an insider who knows what the hell they're talking about, and not some random person that like read 45 minutes of, you know, they read 37 pages of a book from 1987, and now they know, you know, they understand with Fabio. Fabio. It's always Fabio. With Fabio. Yeah. I mean, like
Fabio had actually maybe retired by 1987. I can't remember when he retired.
Fabio has not been on a romance cover, I think, for 30 years.
Yeah, something like that.
No one has had Fabio that is a romance writer that published something. Like my first book came out in 2005 and Fabio was gone.
Right.
So we're talking about 20
It's years like what ago. It's like as if you were talking about Barbara Cartland in a fluffy pink peignoir, you know, reclined on a settee, dictating her stuff. It's like, you know, she's dead, right?
Yes, she has been dead for a long time.
Right.
I mean, it's very, or like saying that, like, you know, well, one great modern fiction writer is Charles Dickens. Like, what?
Right.
Victorian Charles Dickens? Okay.
Right.
But again, exactly. I mean, it's this outsider view that doesn't really take into account the reality, because they think, you know, I mean, they know that they're going to get clicks and people are going to engage. And I guess they don't really care. Over at Slate, it didn't seem like they really cared if it was.
No, they absolutely didn't. They didn't care.
You know, well, I mean, the
thing is, too, is that, okay, fine. You say, you know, even if you are being entirely sincere and you say, let's have this conversation, when you are told this conversation is ongoing, it is your duty, if you are at all intellectually curious, and in the case of journalists, if you're at all professional, in my opinion, to say, oh, well, then I need to do a little more work here. Because if you're going to, quote unquote, have that conversation, you're going to be starting from step one. We are already at step 53, right?
Right.
So you're going to have, you're so far behind the actual discourse. And it's like, you know, it's Valentine's Day. It's also Groundhog's Day because it keeps happening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we keep going back to that first step, which is really tedious. And we should probably just stop talking about this because it just ends up being the same rant.
It's just more, it's the same. We're just ranting and it's fine.
Yeah.
But I mean, it is something that, again, I mean, I think that it just happens. I think this is probably a conversation that's happened around the February 14th episode of every one of these because something always happens.
Yeah. Always.
Well, so one of the things that people like, I think, like, maybe I'm wrong. You can tell me, people, about what they like is understanding other people's processes. So what is your process from like idea to writing? Are you a plotter? Are you a pantser? Are you something in between? Like, how do you make an Adele Buck book?
I am an evolving soul. Let's put it that way. I started out as really pretty much almost a pure pantser. The first manuscript I ever wrote, which will never see the light of day, was pantsed. But for your listeners who might not know what that means it's literally you're flying by the seat of your pants. Some people use the metaphor of like you're driving only to, you know, you're driving in a car at night and you can only see as far as what your headlights illuminate. So usually that's like a scene or maybe a chapter. And so I like working that way because I like getting surprised because, you know, we always say our character surprises. It's really probably our subconscious that's surprising us. I was talking to my brother the other day and I was talking about, so the characters in book two, I said to him, I said, yeah, these two are really horny. And he said, you do realize you made them up. And I said, I know that.
But
that they do surprise you. It's like, you know, you suddenly, you know, like you're in the back of your brain, what's happening at, you know, probably at a level that you're not consciously aware of is you're saying, well, why this? And then your subconscious gives you maybe this happened to them in their past or something like that. So I like working that way. So basically what I was doing was for that first book was it was pretty much pants. But what I was doing was I was doing a modern spin on Jane Austen's Persuasion. So I was essentially using Persuasion as almost like an outline. So I kind of had an outline, but it was very loose. And actually Acting Up is an even looser spin on Jane Austen's Lady Susan, which is a lesser known work. It's not one of the big six, but it was made into a movie by Whit Stillman a few years ago called Love and Friendship with Kate Beckinsale. So I worked like that for a while. I kind of did these Austen pastiches. And then I really started to kind of go, completely out of that box and just start to, because I'm a former actress, I think about character first. So I would, you know, I would think of, you know, who is, you know, what, because I was writing in this series, I already had the beginnings of the characters, you know, that acting right. up kind of set the stage, literally. Yeah. I didn't mean to do that. I just, you know, yeah.
But so it was right Snyder, there. You had to
be
take
proud
it.
Of me. Yeah, Suleika Snyder, please be proud of me. She's the queen of puns.
I love Suleika.
I do too. So anyway, so I already. And what's funny is that my second book was supposed to be in acting up. There's a couple in the, kind of in the background. You were clearly getting together, and I always thought that that was going to be the second book. And I finished this first draft, and I took a nap. And I got up and I had an online writing group at the time, which was, it was funny as I was a big, big fan of the Miss Fisher Mysteries. And so we had this fandom group that actually, we had a Slack instance and they still do. They're great. And we would trade fanfic or I would put out scenes in real time to them on Slack and, you know, get really fast commentary from them. And when I woke up, there was this message from Rosemary, who's one of the people in the group, and she said, I think Alicia is up to something. And Alicia is, so I mentioned that the antagonist, Susan, in Acting Up, has this ongoing email correspondence with her actress frenemy, and that's Alicia. And Alicia's in an entirely different production. She's down in Washington, D.C., doing Romeo and Juliet at the Folger Theater. And Rosemary's single comment sent me spinning off. I hadn't really thought that much about Alicia, except that she's a real foil for Susan, and she's one of the few people on the planet who knows exactly how much of an unreliable narrator Susan is. And so I was like, okay, Freddie and James can be on hold for now. I'm going after Susan. I'm going after Alicia, sorry. And so I wrote this book. And essentially I was just sort of like, okay, so she's in DC. Who would she meet on Capitol Hill? Oh, she'd meet a lobbyist. Ooh, boy, that's not really great. That's not really great, role for a hero. But wait, what if he was a lobbyist for something good, like STEM education, like, to make him into a hero, you know, right. worthy character. And so that's kind of how my brain works with coming up with the initial stuff. And then from there, it just kind of spins out like, it, you know, how they bounce off of one another, because I always think of scenes between characters as almost like scene study, again, acting, right. going back to that's where I base all of my, really all of my thought processes, because that's how I think is as an actress and as, you know, building out a character. But usually you have, unless you're doing
right.
improv,
then
you have a text already, and
right.
now I'm creating the text instead. So it's a little bit more like improv, but anyway, so I did seven books like that, you know, after, you know, Acting Up included. And then I was getting, you know, rejections from New York, and, you know, a lot of my rejections said, this reads almost like women's fiction. And so my agent had been kind of gently saying, do you think you might ever want to write anything that's not genre romance? And at first I was like, no. And then I had this experience where my husband had a health scare, frankly, and I have his permission to talk about it. And I kind of wrote a book around it, something very similar happening. And it's almost a stealth romance, because it's basically a marriage in trouble romance.
Right.
And it alternates chapters, and like chapter one is in the past where they met, and chapter two is in the present. And then they alternate like that. So the odd number chapters are all in the past, and the even number chapters are all in the present. So you can bet that I had to plot that book.
Yeah.
And what's really aggravating is I got in touch with Victoria Dahl. Now, Victoria Dahl used to be a romance writer, and I don't think she's ever coming back to us as a romance writer. She's still a fan of the genre. She's still a wonderful human being. And now she writes psychological thrillers. And her first psychological thriller was called Evelyn After. Or Evelyn After is probably more to rhyme with ever. And the first chapter is before. The second chapter is after. And it becomes very clear to you very quickly that there is an event, you know, between the before and the after.
that you're building toward here.
It's really masterful. It's really skillful. And so I said, can I ask you some questions about your process when you were writing that book? She's like, yeah, sure. So we kind of, sat down on Twitter DMs and chatted back and forth. And she's like, oh, I pants that thing. And I was like, what?
Right, because it makes sense that something like that, and again, this is from a sort of a plantser, I'm in between.
Yeah.
Because anytime I have something that's a little bit of has a mystery element to it, like, I feel like I have to be a little more precise.
Right.
So that I don't mislay the clues, or mislay the line of that, which feels like it needs more sort of finessing for me. But I know that there's people that they write like full-ass mysteries and they never it's so interesting to me, like, how differently everyone works. So she just pantsed it, and you were so, but you clearly, so has that changed? If you had to do a little more plotting or some sort of loose level of plotting for that, has that changed how you're going to do romances in the future? Or you think you're going to go back to it? You think you're going to hit something in the middle? I mean, I think that there's something to be said for always evolving your strategy or your process.
I think that Any Minute Now, which was the manuscript that the first women's fiction manuscript that I wrote, I think that did change me fundamentally, because when I wrote my next women's fiction, which is called Re-Sisterhood, that one also, it had a very big twist, and I knew the twist was coming, so I knew I kind of needed to do some planning. But what I've learned is that, in terms of planning, like, I know that there are people like Christy Barth who absolutely obsessively plot every single thing that's going to happen. And I'm like, isn't that just writing the book? But it's not for her. She's got, like, apparently she's got, like, big binders of stuff that she, she plans everything out, and that works for her. And I'm like, if I did that, I would really feel like I'd already wrote the book and it wouldn't be interesting to me anymore. And I would just put it aside and I wouldn't be able to work on it, because it's that some of that I need to leave a little room for discovery and a little room for serendipity to creep in around the edges, because otherwise I'm just going to be like, I know what happens. I'm bored. And we know what happens when Adele or Adele's body get bored. They turn soft tissue into bone.
You chew the arm off the sofa, and then your entire body turns to stone. Sure.
Exactly. That's exactly what happens. I am reverse Medusa or something. I don't know. at any rate, so my process has changed. And it's funny because I have, seven romance manuscripts, in the pipeline, ready to go, bam, bam, bam. The things that I am working on right now, and I say things, is because I have sort of two things that are about halfway first drafted, and neither of them are romance. One of them is, so I had this idea maybe a year and a half ago. I was like, and I said to my agent, I said, I want to do a Me Too revenge comedy that's basically 9 to 5 meets Charlie's Angels. And my agent was like, Me Too manuscripts haven't really been hitting the market very well, and I don't know, and something other thing, and she's doing her job, right? And I'm like, but I want to do it.
But I want
Yes, I'm really an adult. I really am. Yep. And she's like, and literally my agent could have been my daughter. I mean, in terms of age differentials, I really sometimes had to remind myself, do not be a brat to this woman who's half your age. Just don't. So it's a bad look. So I kind of pushed back a little bit. I'm like, I really want to do this. And she said, well, write a couple chapters and send it to me, and let me, I'll let you know what I think. So I did, and I sent it to her, and she sent it back to me, and she's like, as with everything you do, I like it, but I really don't think that it's going to go anywhere. And so I was kind of like, okay. And so I started thinking about some other stuff, and I always also try to think about, like, what kind of experiences do I have that, I mean, nobody's experience is entirely unique, probably, but what experiences do I have that are maybe a little bit different. And so one of the things that I have in my background is that I went to a private prep school in New England. So I thought, the one Austen book that I always thought was kind of like absolutely impossible to kind of bring into the modern era is Northanger Abbey. Because, you know, the heroine is so naive and, you know, it's, there's so much, you know, stuff going on and that's very melodramatic. And I, you know, it's a gothic. And I was like, but what if, I finally had this idea. I was like, but what if this woman is escaping a bad relationship and she took a job as a music teacher in a boarding school in like Central Coast, Maine, because I'm also, I went to law school up in Maine. And so I know that area of the world still a little bit. And what if like she's basically Catherine Morland, except for that maybe she's actually being gaslit.
Right.
And like, cause the thing is there's a lot of New England boarding schools that are either housed entirely or partially in like old mansions. So,
which
you know,
just lends itself to creepy shit.
Exactly. So what if this was like an enormous Gothic revival mansion and she's living in the mansion itself and, you know, like in an apartment in the tower, because a lot of teachers in boarding schools, you know, get housed at, you know, in apartments on site at the boarding school. And so I started writing this, and it was a lot of fun, and my agent was really excited about the idea. And then, you know, then Resisterhood went out on a limited basis, and, you know, we were still getting the same feedback. And I was like, really, we're getting the same feedback? This is a book with violent death and an enormous twist. This is not like anything I've ever written before. And she said she thought that maybe it was just that, you know, people, I was, I'd been out there enough that people knew what they expected and they weren't really reading it with a fresh eye, mm-hmm. which is possible. And so that, you know, so when I made the decision, you know, to make the break and go on my own, I was chatting with Jace Ellis, and she said, okay, so now are you going to write me that Charlie's Angels meets 9 to 5 book now? Could you please do that? Because I've been waiting for that book. I want that book. So, so I kind of put Northanger Academy off to the side for a little while, like let that marinate because it had kind of hit a snag anyway. And so I, you know, when I go back to writing, that's really what I'm going to be writing. And there are romantic subplots in both of them, but they are not like capital R romances.
Yeah.
So sorry, that was a really long discursive answer to your question.
Well, but I mean, I think when you're, I think the process of, because a lot of times new authors come and they talk to me about, like, this is my process, but, and this is how I have to, so it's like, because this has been my process, this is my process,
right.
Without that, like, sometimes there are blinders that this is how I figured out how to do this. And so if it stops working, I have to keep drilling into it because it's my process. And
exactly.
I think it's always really good to talk about that. So many of us have developed a process over the years. Like, people have gone from being plotters to pantsers. People have gone from being pantsers to plotters. People have found something in the middle. People have realized that their brain works a certain way. And so they have to, you know, do it a very different way. I mean, there's people that are quilters, you know, there are people that write completely out of order. There's people, I mean, it's,
yeah,
I know it stuns my system, but it also works.
Right.
And so, I mean, ultimately that's the thing, is that like, if you change because of something you wrote or something you experienced or something you did or something you felt, and that, but you're still able to produce books, then there's nothing wrong with trying out different processes. The only thing that isn't right about writing is something that doesn't allow you to finish books.
Right.
You know what I mean? You're not finishing books, then your process is not working, is not serving you.
Right.
It doesn't mean it's a wrong process. It just means it's not serving you. So then you have to find the process that does. And I think that being open to that so early in your publishing career is a really smart thing.
Well, I also think that, and this is a lesson I really learned when I was writing the third book in the Center Stage series, which is Freddie and James's book. So if people have read Acting Up and they really want their Freddie and James fix, they're going to get it. And is that, so I'd written at that point in my history 4 manuscripts. So I'd written the Persuasion analog, I'd written a Sense and Sensibility analog, may or may not hit the light of day someday, because it's a better book than the first one. But, and then I wrote Acting Up, and then I wrote Method Acting, which is the second one. And then the election of 2016 happened. And I had been, for 4 manuscripts, I had been able to hit very, very reliably a 1,000 word per day pace. That was very doable for me. And all of a sudden I couldn't.
Yeah.
And I realized, I was like, okay. And I fought with myself for maybe a week on that one. And I went, okay, so cut it in half, do 500, see how that works.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden that book started to flow, because also one of the things that, you know, that happened to me is, as a pantser, sometimes you can write yourself into a corner a little bit, and not necessarily plot wise, but I kept looking at what I had written and thinking, why is this so airless? Now, why does this feel so inert to me? And I realized it's because I had written basically almost only scenes that contained the main couple. Mm-hmm. I was like, their world needs to be bigger, right. You know, literally. And so when I, as soon as I started bringing in characters from the previous books and, you know, reiterating that these people still have these relationships, but that they've grown and they've changed because it's been a couple of years, that all of a sudden now the book started to breathe. Which was a great lesson too, which is, you know, because you got to kind of sometimes be able to stand back from what you've written and really take a fresh look at it and say, oh, wait, this is like, you know, a locked room mystery. These two people have not talked to anybody else for pages. Right. This is wrong.
And unless that's what I was going for, this isn't working.
Right. This is not a only one bed, you know, locked away in a snowstorm.
They're trapped on a train during a snowstorm or something.
Exactly.
Right. Like you gotta like.
So, you know, no, they're in Manhattan, for crying out loud. There are other people.
Oh yeah. They should go out. There's a lot of really nice restaurants.
Yeah, right. So yeah. So that happened.
Well, I'm like shocked, but we're kind of out of time. So and it's been so fun talking about this stuff, because I mean, you know, I think that because you're so young in your publishing career, I know you've been writing for a long time, but you're so young in your publishing career, like it's just a I mean, I think it's a good thing to talk about that kind of stuff when people are just sort of like starting out. So thank you so much for being open to chatting about that. Do you want to tell everyone what they should look for? I know that your book just came out, and I don't know if the next one, this will be out in a couple, this podcast will be out in like a couple weeks. So
okay.
You want to tell them about what's coming or what just happened, or
well,
both?
So my first book, Acting Up, is already out. It's available at all retailers, or at least almost all of them. Most of them. I've tried to make it as wide as possible. The second book, called Method Acting, will be out in April, probably mid to late April. I have a date in mind, but just in case it ends up slipping, I don't want to be totally, you know, pin that down.
Gotta be loosey-goosey.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. But that should come out, in mid to late April. As I mentioned, that's going to be Alicia's story, and she gets to meet a super sexy lobbyist in Washington, D.C., and what happens next? We shall see.
Dot, dot, dot.
Yes. yeah, hopefully, if you were a theater nerd as a younger person, or still are, as I said on Twitter, I wrote these books for the people who would tear up when Neil Patrick Harris in the 2013 Tony Awards said, you know, basically, I wish I had the quote in front of me, you know, for, you know, you kids at home, you know, looking at us thinking, you know, thinking that this is impossible. We were that kid, you know. So if that ever grabbed you, then hopefully these books are for you.
Well, thank you again so much for being here.
Yeah.
This has been Journeys of Romance. I'm Jess Michaels, your host. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next time.